This is City Lights on WABE, where ATL meets NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for joining us. The author and Hollywood screenwriter Anthony Tambakis was born in Connecticut and currently lives in California. In between, he lived in Cabbage Town, where he wrote the first draft of a novel some 14 years ago. That novel is now newly published. I spoke with Anthony Tambakis earlier this week. Here he is reading an excerpt from Swimming with Bridgeport Girls.
From the day I met Elle, there were always people around. When we lived in Atlanta, we were friends with everyone in Cabbage Town. We played on the softball team of Elle's firm. There were always parties to go to, concerts to see. Even around town, you'd always run into people you knew from hanging out in different neighborhoods. People in Little Five Points you'd always see at shows, people at the farmer's market in the Highlands who were there every Saturday, people you'd run into at the Starlight Drive-In, people tailgating in Athens. It was a full world.
Please tell us about the situation surrounding the first draft of this book.
Oh, we're going to go right there. Okay. I had a, what's the best way to put this? Catastrophic breakup? Disastrous breakup, all of those things. So I was totally in love with this girl named Rachel, redhead, really vibrant girl. And anyway, so we split up after three or four years, and that preceded me moving out to LA to start screenwriting. But the last thing I did in Atlanta was lock myself in our old apartment in Cabbage Town, which actually was above a stained glass and pottery shop. And I wrote this first draft in spiral notebooks over like 3 or 4 months, and I had no money. I mean, I was just broke, so I would trot up to the gas station on the corner because they had 2-for-1 79-cent hot dogs, and like 2-liter bottles of Coke were like 49 cents. So you could be set, you know. I might have spent like $9 a week while I was writing this book, but I ate nothing but hot dogs and Coke and wrote the first draft. And then that was just the beginning. That started it. And then I moved out to California and wrote about 4,000 further revisions of this. So, it was finally satisfied and could release it into the world.
Atlanta and other regional locales familiar to Atlantans, such as Athens, figure prominently in your novel, Anthony. Let's enter the story. It has an attention-grabbing opening line. And this sets up a scenario that's very funny, but also conveys serious problems that Ray, the protagonist, must deal with.
Yeah, well, the book opens when he kidnaps his dog, which he doesn't consider a kidnapping because it's his dog, though he did steal it from his ex-wife's house. So she would view it as kidnapping. This would be this kind of parsing of situations and who is not to blame is something I had a lot of fun with throughout, because this is one of those narrators he's writing it in the past tense, so he's a little bit self-aware, but he's also not. So I wanted to start the book off with something punchy and a really fun opening chapter.
The structure of the book is such that at the beginning of each chapter there appears in italics a diary entry. What does this provide the reader?
Well, okay, so I did that last. So the diary entries are his ex-wife. And again, when you meet him at the beginning, he's stolen the dog from her house. Another thing you might discover is that he also stole her journal and photocopied it at Kinko's. He would just rationalize that how else is he going to know what she's thinking, because she won't talk to him. So I decided to use excerpts from her journal to start each chapter to provide a counter voice, because he's a very, like, your classic unreliable narrator, but he's also very charismatic and a good example of the way we tell stories. You know, whenever you sit there and someone tells you their story of heartache, you know, we're always the hero, you know, and he has the ability to make it seem like he's doing ridiculous things and completely in the wrong. But he explains himself pretty well, and like anybody who's charismatic, you start to believe him. So I felt that the first draft of this book, or the many drafts, those came last, Lois, the opening. I put them in last for two reasons. One, I absolutely felt that I needed a counterbalance to his voice to contextualize the relationship more. And secondly, and for me as a writer, most what's most interesting to me is when I started this book, I completely related to Ray, the narrator, and his voice was easy for me to find. But when I finished, like, you know, in the end, when it came out, it's 14 years after I, 13 or 14 years after I started, I understood her better because I'm older now and I'm more mature and I understand relationships and people. So me now would have probably written this book from her perspective because I understand what it's like to deal with people like him now in a way that I didn't before. So I wanted to try writing in her voice, and it was a lot of fun to do. And I wrote whole journals in her voice, and then I just picked out snippets. Well, did you like that? Did you think it worked?
I loved it. I thought the whole counter voice was very effective. And I found myself going back and rereading some of the diary entries that Al makes because I find myself sympathizing with her much more as the story progresses. She isn't immediately likable, but becomes so wise. Yeah, it's very effective. Well, introduce us to Ray Parisi.
Okay. Yeah, he's just a train wreck at this point when you meet him. I mean, everything's, you know, when you meet him, which is always a fun place to start a character. I like to, I think stories are fun if you start with the pot already boiling and you just drop your character into it instead of heating it up, just, you know, immediate kind of dramatic scenario. And he lost his wife, who's completely the love of his life and tethered him to reality. He lost his house, which another guy is living in with her. He's living at a motel. He lost his job at ESPN. And the day we met him, he's been arrested for an incident out at Belmont Park. So he's at rock bottom, pretty much, when we meet him. Except he's an extremely optimistic character. So writing about someone at rock bottom who's still optimistic was kind of enjoyable, actually.
The entire plot revolves around Ray trying to win back Elle. And as the story unfolds, we learn that his love for her never diminished. She is the love of his life. And he, or you, express it in breathtaking ways. But we're also getting a vivid depiction of the illness that is compulsive gambling. I was hoping you'd read page 59, beginning with "Given the opportunity."
Sure. Given the opportunity, I bet on everything. I played mostly blackjack, some craps, a little roulette. I also tried my hand at baccarat, mini baccarat, three-card poker, pie-gal poker, and Caribbean stud. Outside the casino, I played the lotto, bought scratch-offs, wagered on horses, dogs, boxing, baseball, college football, the NFL, NCAA hoops, the NBA, the NHL, and even golf. I bet on everything from the World Series to the opening round of the NIT. I wagered on both the Super Bowl coin flip and the outcome of the Academy Awards. Straight bets, parlays, teasers, halftimes, props, wheels, sides, totals. I tried them all.
What initial effect did gambling have on Ray? How does he explain it, that rush?
It's funny. It's like there's two kinds of, I guess it's like anything else. There's people who have gambled and there's people who haven't. And the people who haven't are completely, they are the most reasonable people on earth. You know, they look at a casino and are like, what's wrong with these people? Like, you know, they look at a $25 chip and they see a gas bill or something, you know, they see the money, which is what it is. And people I know who don't gamble are mystified by why anybody, you know, the house has a massive edge. You know, casinos never close, ever. So that gives you a good idea that they're in a pretty smart business. And they can't believe why people do it. But then there's the people who, when you do it, there's a certain kind of, there's just a rush. There's an adrenaline boost that kicks in. And it's very potent. And I can definitely speak from experience on that. Because we started gambling when we were kids. We started gambling, Lois, when we were like 14, I think.
Really?
There was an adult somewhere in the world. There was an adult in Fairfield, Connecticut. He actually worked at a deli, but I don't remember his name. He booked action from us. We were 14. In the end, we had to borrow $1,800.
That's now, a lot of money for a 14-year-old.
14-year-olds in 1982? $1,800? So think about, I don't know how that even happened or why anybody would ever take action from 14-year-olds who didn't have money, but that was the beginning.
Well, That certainly goes to a question I was going to ask you a little later, but the portrayal of Ray's gambling, the description of that rush, and descriptions of the casinos, the details of Vegas hotels, made me wonder if you had to do a lot of research. And I also wondered if you had personal exposure to a compulsive gambler, or if you were one yourself.
Well, you're very generous to call it research, and let's call it research. Yes. it's like anything else, right? It's like you have to, every detail needs to be right for the whoever's out there who does know those details. I don't care if you if you're writing about Ireland, you know, for the three people who might read it who are, you know, live there, it has to be right. So I lived at the MGM for a little while. I did a lot of research, just detail research. But as far as understanding the world and having a long history with it, which I don't have anymore, but oh my God, yes, definitely. For good and for bad, a lot of epic gambling stories, but also a lot of, in the end, it creates a lot of problems, Lois. It's an addiction like anything else,
yeah.
You know? But gambling's tricky because it has a payback to it. So, like, if you have a more rudimentary addiction, like, I don't know, cocaine, food, whatever you want, sex, you have a compulsion to do a thing, and then you do that thing, and then it feels good, and then you pay whatever price there is to pay for that, and that's it. But with gambling, it feels good. You get the rush that you do from a drug, right? But then you can also win money. There's a second part of it, you know? So the rush is betting on the game, but the second part of it is, wait a second, you could actually, you know, win. And no other addiction has that, which makes gambling one of the most difficult things to quit, because it has the idea of breaking even is always in your mind. So when you look back at all you've lost, right? A coke addict can't get that time or horrible decisions back. But a gambler thinks, I know how much I lost. If I could just get back to even, everything will be all right. And no other addiction offers that, and that's why it's hard to quit.
Tell us about the Kinder's house and how Ray and Elle discovered it.
Yeah, so his ex, Elle, grew up in Athens, out in Clark County, and very poor, single mother, apartments on the other side of the university tracks. And there was a couple named the Kinders who had a barn, and they raised and bred golden retrievers. And so as a child, her mother would take her to the Kinder house, which was this, you know, beautiful farmhouse outside of Athens, and she would go play with the golden retriever puppies. It was the memory of her childhood. And she told him that story when they met. And so in his mind, this is the idea that he gets in a Gatsby-esque kind of gesture. And, you know, instead of buying the house across the bay, his idea is he's going to somehow make the money. The interesting thing is he has to gamble. The thing that caused all his problems are the only thing that's going to get him out of it. Again, so that's gambling for you, right? So he thinks if he buys her this house, she'll come back. And that's his grand plan. He's going to present it in this huge gesture. He needs $2 million, and he wants to buy the Kinder house for her.
So he flees to Vegas, not only to win money, but also because he's on the lam, you mentioned a little earlier.
He's on the lam, yes. He has to, so there's a ticking clock going on here the whole time, which makes the book kind of cinematic. I'm working on a screenplay now, so I think it's going to make a good movie because it has a lot of forward momentum and chaos to it.
How did you know what my last question was going to be?
I don't know.
You're a successful screenwriter, Anthony, and this is your first novel, albeit it had a lengthy gestation.
Yeah.
But that might mean that it will live that much longer. The book contains some laugh-out-loud humor and heartbreak and colorful characters and interesting locations and tons of action. What was different for you in writing a novel rather than a screenplay? Because as I was reading this, I was visualizing it. Cinematic is the word that came to mind.
Yeah, so it reads cinematic because obviously I have that training. So the simplest way to describe it is, you know, movies are all exterior. They're all visual. The audience can only know what they see. So you have to be alert all the time. And this can include, whether it's people's backstories, exposition, what someone's feeling, how people are feeling when you come into a scene. All the things that you can do. Fiction writing is all interior. You know, you're writing all about in people's interior lives. So I can go into Lois's head for 500 pages if I want to. But that option doesn't exist when you're writing for the screen. It all has to be visual. So you have to think about, what is the audience seeing? How much can they know here? And how can I let them know things through visuals? So that was the biggest difference. You know, to be honest with you, screenwriting is a much simpler process for me. Like, I don't consider that nearly even in the neighborhood of the art form that fiction writing is. It comes with a computer program, actually. It has a thing called Final Draft, and everybody has to get it, and you use it, so the structures are all the same. So it's an art form that immediately tells you what its own limitations are. It has to look a certain way. It has to be a certain length. All the respect is in the literary world, but there's no money there. And all the money is in Hollywood, but there's no respect for language there. So it's, there you go.
Well, you can do your part. Anthony Tambakis, this has been a real pleasure.
Lois, I feel the same way, and I really appreciate your time, and it was great to hear your voice, and thank you for caring about books. It's so great. Thank you.